Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Hey, if you're just joining us, you can catch the first hour of our program by becoming a member of our podcast. It's the best way to help support this show. You'll get the full show, commercial-free, plus bonus content you won't find anywhere else. Just go online to rofpodcast.com to sign up. Joining me now for our coverage of the Ring of Fire News of the Week, Mike Papantonio. So, Pap, we are learning more and more what the Donald Trump administration cabinet is going to look like. This week, I should say at the end of last week, he announced that, among others, that Jeff Sessions is going to be his attorney general, which is a rather shocking turn of events, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think, it's just typical of the media. They focused on a couple of things and miss the other huge pictures. This is a guy who wants to shut down the civil justice process for everybody except corporations suing corporations. He was Karl Rove's right-hand henchman where it came to packing the Alabama Supreme Court and appellate courts with people who were barely, this is no exaggeration when I tell you they were barely even lawyers with law degrees. They were simply people who did the bidding of the Republican Party to trash the Democrats in Alabama. This is a vicious little character. There's no other way I can describe Jeff Sessions. It wasn't that he was perfect for Alabama, but Alabama is not a reflection, fortunately, of the rest of the country. And I mean, you know the story, of course, about his problems with race. His whole idea about the Voting Rights Act was to say that it was too intrusive, that we don't need it, that Alabama and Mississippi and the southern states were so far ahead that there's no need for a Voting Rights Act, which is going to give you a lot of indication about what he's going to do in regard to really trying to ferret out voter fraud. What he's going to do is he's going to go after voter fraud in a big way. As a matter of fact, he did that. He's done it already. He targeted a handful of black activists who were just in the process of trying to get people registered to vote. And by the end of it, it was just all a scam. Out of 1.7 million votes cast, they found fewer than 10 votes that even had where there was even a question about the registration. But nevertheless, he went on national media knowing that and talked about how he had saved the system from voter fraud. This is a dangerous little guy in so many respects. He's got things he can do in regard to enforcing laws. In the environmental issues, enforcing laws where Wall Street is stealing mom and pop's money, enforcing issues where the pharmaceutical industry is creating dangerous products that are killing people and him taking no action. The Chamber of Commerce has given Jeff Sessions more money than he could possibly spend because he is purely a corporatist that is there for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They created this guy. They built his career, and if the Democrats ever want to show that they have a backbone, this is the place to do it. My bet is that they won't, because we just know too much about them.
You know what they can do. I mean, we'll see if it's possible they'll have the 40 votes to filibuster here. I mean, but you hear folks like Joe Manchin. From West Virginia, you've got another handful of senators running in red states. I mean, the amazing thing about this Jeff Sessions character is that, he has a very long record and you've spelled out a good chunk of it here in terms of things like civil rights, and which is not to say that someone can't have a tarnished civil rights record, right? When he sees the Voting Rights Act and says that's an intrusive piece of legislation, or he targets black activists because they're registering voters in Alabama, or he has no problem with blatant racism coming out of the mouths of judges in Alabama, et cetera, et cetera. If this guy had gone on in his career as a senator to show that he had turned some major leaf, Pap, right? Like if this guy had gone on to fight for reconstituting the Voting Rights Act after the Supreme Court gutted it in 2011, then I think that we would have a different perspective on this. But there's no indication that this guy has changed even remotely in this respect. He's going to be the chief law enforcement officer in the country. And here's what really scares me about a character like this, Pap. You see the Trump administration now, without, you know, putting aside the sort of more, I guess, banal and typical problems that we have with corporatists. You know, Eric Holder, for that matter, was also a corporatist. I don't know that he'll be as a giveaway artist as Jeff Sessions. But even putting that aside, we see his administration, the Trump administration, being staffed, dancing around just about every Islamophobe in this country who holds any type of credential, right? Whether it's Frank Gaffney running the transition, whether it's going in and bringing Tulsi Gabbard, who he doesn't agree with except for on her problems with Muslims, it seems to me. You've got Bannon in there. You've got Flynn, who is off the charts when it comes to this stuff. And, you know, who knows where they're leading? But you got a guy like Jeff Sessions, who clearly has disdain for things like civil rights.
Yeah, but see, here's the problem, Sam. I'm with you on civil rights. Okay, I got it. I'm with you on voting. I'm with you that these things that are front page, top of the fold issues. What the media doesn't understand is this guy does damage far worse than what he's going to do with civil rights. Okay? He has at his fingertips ways to shut down any type of activity that might bring Wall Street under control. Now, you think the inaction by Holder and the inaction by Loretta Lynch is disgusting. Wait till you see the affirmative steps that Sessions is going to make to where it's easier for Wall Street to steal from people and not get fined and not get prosecuted. Wait till you see what Jeff Sessions is going to do to lobby to make it more difficult for the average American to take a corporation to court when the corporation has caused somebody's death in that person's family. Wait till you see what Jeff Sessions is able to do without legislation to shut down any type of meaningful prosecution of the worst catastrophic polluters in the world coming to the United States and destroying our rivers, our streams, and our air. Now, here's the problem, Sam. We have such a narrow vision media. I mean, the average reporter out there is, forgive me.
Let's take a break, Pat, because when we come back, I want to talk about this story of all the top network executives and anchors meeting with Donald Trump Monday. One can only imagine what that conversation is going to be like. We got to take a quick break. Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio, here with Mike Papantonio. We'll be back in a second.
Your body may be gone. I'm going to carry you in my head, in my heart, in my soul. And maybe we'll get lucky.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with my co-host, Mike Papantonio, running through this pretty disastrous week in news. So, Pap, you mentioned at the end of the last segment that we cannot rely on the mainstream, the corporate media, to report to us on how a guy like Jeff Sessions is just basically going to say it's basically open season on corporate malfeasance in this country. Yeah. Earlier this week, you had a sit down, and I think this is, I don't know how unprecedented it is, but it seems to be pretty close. I mean, it's one thing you talk about meeting with reporters, but executives and anchors from the country's five biggest television networks and meeting with Donald Trump this week at Trump Tower. And we can only imagine what's going on here. But the idea that the media, I mean, you know, look, we've had just in the past couple of days, Pat, we're having, you know, and it's true, Kurt Eichenwald from Newsweek reported on some of this stuff. But we're watching a cavalcade of what can only be called just pure kleptocracy. You've got Indian business leaders who are getting meeting with the president-elect in exchange for Trump's business dealings to go a little more smoothly there. Donald Trump's on the phone with the president of Argentina, Mauricio Marci, and who called President-elect Trump to congratulate him, and Trump turns around and says, "Hey, you know, I'm having trouble building a major office building in Buenos Aires. Can you make sure that you know, the financing and the regulations that are slow holding that up? Can you get rid of those?" I mean, this is unbelievable. This is like Banana Republic stuff, right?
Yeah.
And where was the media talking about this, you know, setting a standard, educating the public on what is appropriate in terms of commingling business interests and not, you know, Jimmy Carter, you'll remember, had to sell his peanut farm.
Yeah.
He had to sell his peanut farm. Like, how much could the United States president impact a peanut farm? Nevertheless, he had to sell it. Compare this with Donald Trump, and we haven't seen his taxes. We have no idea. We have no idea the web of his financial interests around the globe. But we've already seen the implications of it coming out of India. We've already seen the implications of it coming out of Argentina. We've already seen his family members going on TV and literally hawking jewelry in the context of the presidency. People who are supposedly running his company instead of a blind trust.
Well, look, let's go back.
And are meeting with world leaders. I mean, this is just...
Let's go back, though, to where you started.
He's not even president yet.
Sam, let's go back to where you started. You started talking about Trump meeting with the media. Okay. Let me put it out there for you. There are only a finite number of protections that the average American consumer, the average American has, period. One of them is that we have regulatory agencies that are supposed to do their job unless they are commandeered by somebody like Trump, which is already happening with the EPA, the FDA, the SEC, you name it. Okay, that's what we expect as Americans. That's what holds democracy together. The next thing we expect is, well, okay, if they don't, regulators don't do it, what about the court system? What about the judges? Are they going to do it? Well, no, because what you're going to have is 109 hacks, absolute, utter, not jurists, but politicos who've hung in there with the Republicans on their most fringe extreme issues. Okay? That's the second area that we think we have protection. Then the third is, oh, well, gee, if the regulators and the judges don't protect us, surely the media is going to be there for us. But now we have a corporate media that is simply trying to look for advantages with this new presidency. Can they get tax breaks? Can they get access to the White House? Can they continue to merge
and
build conglomerates?
Right. Of course.
Okay, so the fourth thing is lawyers. Maybe lawyers are going to take some of these folks to task and try to get them in court. And if it can't go to federal court, maybe they're going to go to state court and fight it out there. You're going to have Sessions come up with immunity issues where you can't sue a pharmacist, I mean a pharmaceutical company. You can't sue a polluter. He will have an agenda of what we call immunity bills. And so those are the four areas. If you can think of another one, please tell me, because I can't think of another one. And I've been doing this a long time, man. And so those four areas have now been commandeered by a psycho, is the easiest way to put it. And what's going to happen is exactly what you would expect. These are dark days for consumers ahead. These very people who voted for Trump thinking, what a glorious thing is, we're going to be able to keep immigrants out. How glorious, we're going to have an internment camp for Muslims. How glorious, maybe we're going to get some jobs back, maybe. No, we're going to get a tax break. By the time this is over, the average consumer is going to look around and say, what just happened to me? That's my prediction.
Yeah, I mean, if there's going to be a moment to catch our breaths, I mean, you know, to watch how they are, you know, and what we're talking about when we talk about those networks is in dynamic. We're going to see across across industries too, where they are weaponizing government,
yeah,
and using it as a tool to discipline people far afield from maintaining the social compact.
That's right?
I mean, merger rules apply to companies that he doesn't like.
Yeah.
They don't apply to companies he likes.
Corporate media is now trying to take control of the internet. That's what they're meeting with Trump about. So that's the State of the Union as Pap sees it.
Well, I mean, I wish I had a more a cheery retort to that, but I frankly don't either. I mean, everything that we it was in place to protect us from this type of thing, it seems to me, to not be able at this juncture going forward, it doesn't look like it's going to, you know, we're not seeing any great sort of markers of dissent, or we're, you know, you're already starting to see New York Times reporters saying, like, really inappropriate to boo somebody at,
yeah, let's all get along,
at this
right.
theater. I mean, give me a break here. The president of the United States just appointed an avowed racist to be the chief law enforcement officer of the country. You know, let's have a little bit of a perspective. But, Pap, we're going to have more to talk about this until they drag us out of our studios, which, you know.
By the way, I'll be doing America's Lawyers starting in about 2 weeks on RT Network, possibly the only TV network that will allow you to tell a story like the stories we're going to be telling on America's Lawyer.
Could be. All right, folks. So we got to take a break. Ring of Fire Radio, Sam Cedar, Mike Papantonio. Thanks so much, Pat.
Thank you.
When we come back, author and law professor David Cohen will explain the unprecedented nature of the Republicans' theft of a seat to the Supreme Court. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
Can't stop addicted to the shindig. Chop top, it says I'm going to win big. Choose not to like.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. President Obama's time is running out, and one seat will remain open on the Supreme Court. Here to explain how unprecedented the act of the Republicans' obstruction to the nominee of Merrick Garland is Drexel Law Professor David Cohen. So, Professor, you know, I just read a piece this week that, I should say I read a piece this week that... that suggested, and it struck me as being quite on point, that in doing this unprecedented, I want to talk to you about whether or not this is unprecedented, but by not seating and not even confirming, not even having a hearing, not even meeting with in any meaningful way, President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, that the Republicans were able to use this in the election and to great effect insofar as a lot of conservatives who might otherwise have been reluctant to rally around Donald Trump saw this fifth vote on the Supreme Court, this swing vote, as being that much more crucial. And that struck me as a great point. And probably, you know, when we're talking about 75,000 votes in three states, could have made the difference in this election. But put into context for us, like, how is there any precedent for what the Republicans did? I mean, how is it that there was no contemplation of a political party doing something like this?
There is no precedent for what they did. I mean, they stole a Supreme Court seat. Supreme Court vacancies don't arise on a regular basis. When they do, it's the prerogative of the president to fill the Supreme Court vacancy with someone who supports the president's ideology, or at least the president likes their ideology. And the Republicans obstructed in an unprecedented way in order to steal this seat. And they took a gamble, because what the president hoped for was that by obstructing like this, the Republicans would suffer the consequences at the ballot box. And the Republicans hoped that if they obstructed like this, they could get the next presidency and keep the Senate and get the seat for themselves. And they won the gamble. It turned out their way, and they were successful in mobilizing their base to vote for the Supreme Court. And the Democrats were unsuccessful in mobilizing their base to vote for President Obama's nominee and against the Senate obstructionism. So the Republicans won this. I wouldn't say fair and square, because it's so unprecedented and it goes against what our Constitution expects. But they won this, and they stole a Supreme Court seat away from the Democrats.
This is like you say, it's unprecedented. What is the recourse in that situation? Is there no recourse? I mean, I can't even begin to, like, you know, how would this seems to me to be, you know, a question of, I guess, separation of powers in some fashion. And I guess theoretically, like, if there was a chance for it to be resolved, it would have gone to the Supreme Court, which, of course, was divided 4-4, probably. I mean, were there any options here, aside from perhaps maybe President Obama choosing someone who would have more resonance in the election, and aside from the Clinton campaign making more of an issue of it, was there any type of recourse? I mean, is there? What do we do in these situations?
Well, I think you hit on the one that I look back on and think was a missed opportunity, which is that the president could have nominated someone who would have galvanized his base. I mean, by all accounts, Merrick Garland's a highly intelligent, well-respected guy, nice guy, but there was nothing about him that galvanized anyone. And so he was quickly forgotten, and he never became a campaign issue. If President Obama had nominated someone who could have helped diversify the court, or would have been young and exciting to be on the court for another 30, 40 years, in some way, Democrats could have latched on to this person. I think that the outcome might have changed and more Democrats would have been energized. And this was a completely missed opportunity on the president's behalf. But then again, he also didn't expect the Republicans to obstruct in this historically unprecedented way. But in terms of recourse, there's no lawsuit that would ever be heard in any federal court, let alone the Supreme Court, over this. The Supreme Court and the federal courts don't hear things that they call political questions. And those are things that they think are better suited for the political branches and the political process. And that's what the court would have said this is. The president could do two different things. I don't think either one which would be successful, but some people have written about this in various places. The president has the power to appoint someone to fill a vacancy when the Senate is not in session. And technically, and that vacant that appointment lasts until the Senate the next Senate session is over. So technically, there's a gap in the Senate sessions when they turn over on January 3rd. So the president could appoint Merrick Garland on January 3rd, right before the new Senate takes office, and he would hold office for 2 years. And some people have suggested he do that, make this what's it's called a recess appointment. I think the trouble with that is that the Republicans in Congress could pass a law saying this current Senate session is now over.
Right.
President Trump would sign that, and Merrick Garland's time on the Supreme Court would end. So I think that they could get around that. Other people have suggested that the president just say, well, you've waited this long. You have given me your consent by doing nothing, and so I'm going to put Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court. And I think that also is a non-starter, because if he signaled he was going to do that, I think the Senate would just vote against Merrick Garland, saying, okay, well, now we'll vote for him, and I mean, now we'll take the vote and we'll vote against him. So I really don't think there is any recourse. I mean, what should have happened is that this should have been an issue that the American people said the Republicans are obstructing good government and voted against it. I wish that Hillary Clinton had made it more of an issue during the campaign. Unfortunately, she didn't. I wish Obama had appointed some or nominated someone who resonated more with Democrats, but he didn't. And here we are.
I don't want to spend too much time on this, but in the first scenario where we're talking about the recess appointment, I mean, there's the ability for a president to recess appointment. We know is limited by the National Labor Relations Board versus Canning holding. This is from a couple of years ago.
Right.
It's not exactly on point. Some people argue that the questions about what constitutes a genuine, or for these purposes, a genuine recess that the court wrote about was dicta. And so that theoretically, right, there could be a lawyer in the DOJ who says, well, Mr. President, the Office of Legal Counsel reviewed this. You actually do have the authority on January 3rd to appoint somebody. I mean, from a political standpoint, I mean, this is like the weird part, right? Like, there's no legal recourse. There's no process here. It's all political. And I don't know. I mean, maybe this is not necessarily your portfolio, but theoretically, right, the president could say, I'm withdrawing, Merrick Garland, and I'm appointing Oprah, right, if I wanted to get, I mean, well, you know, all norms are out the window now. So Oprah gets seated on the Supreme Court, and then the Republicans have to vote her out. Maybe it takes a day or two. Who knows? But there does seem to be a complete lack on the left of an appreciation still of how important the Supreme Court is, which is stunning, because I'm afraid we on the left are about to learn that lesson, and it's going to be a 30-year-old lesson.
Yeah, it's really stunning to me, too. I tried to write about this and call attention to this before the election in various outlets, and I think I saw a statistic after the election that it was over 20% of Republicans said they voted the way they did because of the Supreme Court, and it was less than 15% of Democrats who felt that way. The numbers should have been the same, if not more, for Democrats, because we had an opportunity for something that we haven't had in my lifetime, and I'm 44, which is a progressive Supreme Court. If we had gotten this fifth seat, we would have had a 5-justice progressive, or at least liberal, majority on the Supreme Court, and we haven't seen that since the 60s. It could have reversed all sorts of conservative precedent around criminal justice, the environment, the death penalty, affirmative action, women's rights, abortion, that we've been living with for the past 20, 30 years under what a lot of people think is the most conservative court that has ever been. So this was a hugely missed opportunity on the left. And I agree with you. We could be lamenting this for 3 decades.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, let's talk about, rather than what was, what we anticipate will be. The long and short of it is, it could be a horrific number of decades, but We'll talk about that a little more specifically when we return. Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm here with Drexel Law Professor David Cohen. We've been talking about the Republicans' obstruction to President Obama's Supreme Court nominee. So, Professor, before the break, we talked about the unprecedented nature of what the Republican Party did in, as you call it, stealing a Supreme Court seat. And we are now looking at a 4-4 court. Donald Trump has given us some indication as to who or of what ilk, I should say, his Supreme Court nominee will be. This has come primarily from the Heritage Foundation. I mean, just give me your sense. Obviously, like, you know, so we're outside of the realm of the law as much as we are sort of, I guess, politics in some level. But Donald Trump does not strike me as a guy who thinks too much about legal ideology. Even if he did have one, what are the chances that this guy could actually pick a judge that he thinks would reflect that, as opposed to appointing one that, you know, those who enable him in the Republican Party would choose?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of people who worried about that, and there were a lot of conservatives who worried about that he's such a wild card, he doesn't really understand much about the basic functions of the government, let alone the court system, that he would pick judges who knew what they were going to do. But he gave a list earlier this year of 21 judges who he said would be the list from which he would choose a Supreme Court justice. And those judges were all conservatives, some very conservatives. They were Federalist Society members. And that really pleased a lot of conservatives. Now, of course, we have no idea if he actually will choose from that list. He would upset a lot of people if he did not, because he made that a part of his campaign. But if he does choose from that list, we're going to have a diehard conservative likely on the court. And when that happens, it's not really going to change much, because that would be a diehard conservative replacing Justice Scalia, who was one of the most conservative justices ever. The trouble comes if he gets a second pick. If he gets a second Supreme Court pick and replaces one of the older members of the court right now, that could really change and give us a solid 5-justice conservative majority that could take a wrecking ball to precedents that are still liberal precedents that the court follows, and that's the danger. So it's the second pick that really worries me, if he gets one.
Because right now you see Kennedy as some type of bulwark against the worst of the worst. I mean, of course, you know, without the death of Scalia, we probably have a crippled public sector union movement in this country via Friedrichs, right? Without, you know, had Scalia, let's say, died 3 or 4 years earlier, we would have actually still had an intact Voting Rights Act, which wouldn't have accounted for literally millions of people being disenfranchised. We would have greater access to the courts for tort proceedings and for, I mean, the list goes on and on. So it's either like a slow devolution, right? Because, you know, from an actuarial standpoint, you're going to lose people from the nominally liberal side at the same rate that you are on the nominally right side. Although I guess there's a, but and so I don't know. I mean, I guess we just got to hope that Donald Trump meets somebody at a dinner party who says, like, I'd like to be Supreme Court Justice, and he goes, I like you. Yeah, okay. I mean,
yeah. Or his right, sister. I mean, his sister's a judge on the Third Circuit here in Philadelphia, where I am, and she's a decent liberal. So some people have speculated that, you know, since he's so focused on his family, that he's just going to appoint his sister. And, you know, that would be fine from my perspective. But, you know, the problem for liberals right now is that Justice Ginsburg is 83, and she's a good liberal. Justice Breyer is 78. He's a good liberal. Justice Kennedy is 80, and he's not liberal at all. But he has voted to uphold Roe v. Wade. He has voted to uphold affirmative action, not in all circumstances, but he has protected some things that we care about, and he's been very good on gay rights. If any one of those three, and they're the three oldest on the court, so the conservatives, right. You're right, are getting older, but they are much younger. Those are the three oldest judges on the court, and if one of them retires or leaves the court involuntarily and gets replaced by Donald Trump as president with one of his conservative judges, that would flip the court in a drastic way.
From a let me just ask you from the perspective. I mean, I know how I'm feeling as a liberal talk radio show host, and but from the perspective of a law professor, when you look at these things, I mean, what's your big takeaway here? I mean, so much of what we're seeing, particularly with the Trump administration elect, even at this point. But also with the Republicans and the way that they're destroying norms in dealing with the court, how much does this undercut the sort of the foundations of the institution of law in this country?
I think that's the big question and for the future, and that's something that we're all going to be watching really closely after January 2nd. I mean, it'd be one thing if Donald Trump, as president, institutes all sorts of bad policies, but accepts the basic structure of government and the role of the courts and the role of Congress and the role of the president and doesn't really change that much. Obviously, I'd be against all his policies because I think everything he suggests is pretty terrible, but that would be one thing. It would be another if he does all of that while acting like a CEO, where he says, I'm in charge, I get to do what I want, everyone else has to follow me, I'm not going to listen to Congress, I'm not going to listen to the courts, because I'm the boss. That would be a breakdown of our entire constitutional structure. It would be a threat to our founding principles. It would be a threat to all of our legal norms. And I think there's reason why many people are concerned about that, because of the way he talks, the way he obviously doesn't understand what a president does under our Constitution. And so there's, I think, really good reason to worry about what he might do with respect to all the institutions that are in place to check a president.
Indeed. Professor David Cohen, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
David Cohen is a law professor at the Thomas R. Klein School of Law at Drexel University. He's co-author of the book Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. After the break, Heather Digby Parton will be here to wrap up the Ring of Fire news of the week. We'll take a particular look at the kleptocracy that is the Trump administration elect. And if you missed any part of this show, go to rofpodcast.com and become a member of our podcast. Your support is what keeps Ring of Fire on the air. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and you've been listening to a free sample of Ring of Fire Radio. If you'd like to listen to the full show, subscribe to our weekly podcast at our website at ringoffireradio.com. It's your support that helps keep us on the air.